You're listening to Arts ID. This month's theme, venues.
One of the definitions of a venue is where specific events are held. But what if people decide to start having the event in a place where it wasn't designed to be held? There's a small theater in Sonoma Valley, right on the plaza, a historic theater, the Sebastiani Theater. It's one of those old-time theaters, one single screen. They still even play the classic movies on Monday nights from the 40s and 50s. And the foyer of the theater has become a venue in itself. Instead of using the stage and the screen, which is the intended venue, people have taken on to create their own venue out front. We talked with Roger Roten, the proprietor of the Sebastiani Theater.
Yeah. Has playing in the foyer always been something that happened, or is it something that's a phenomenon that's kind of occurred more recently?
Well, it's always occurred at some point or another, but it's gotten very popular in the last few years, and so more people are actually doing it than ever did in the past. You always have somebody that comes in here because they love the acoustics in there, and so people would come sometimes and play. But now it's starting to get sort of like a venue for a lot of street performers and people that want to sing for their meals, you know, and the money.
What types of performances, what type of performers are we getting these days?
Well, you know, we had the most when we had Arias from, he did the violin, and he played out there on a regular basis just about every night for a long period of time. And he became the first one that actually established a regularity to performing out in front. And then we just recently had the opera singer that came quite frequently out front and performed operas right out in the front of the theater.
The opera singer's actually moved on to Italy, making enough money singing out front to finance her trip to where her dreams are all going to come true. So I guess the moral of this little story is, if you can't find a venue, make one of your own. This has been James Marshall Berry.
Welcome to Arts ID. I'm Gretchen Giles.
I'm Daedalus Howell.
Our theme this month, as Daedalus said, is venues. Arts ID is a monthly audio magazine that's done in collaboration with the North Bay Bohemian, of which I am the proud editrix, the Arts Council of Sonoma County, and KRCB Public Radio, which you're listening to right now. We're going to be talking about different places to do art and all kinds of performance.
I have to say, though, reflecting on James Marshall Berry's piece there, if you don't have a venue, make one. That's a great idea. But sometimes they're a little heavy.
Yeah. They're completely set in stone, for example, as Robin Pressman's going to tell us when she takes us to the Castello di Amoroso in the Napa Valley. Hey, roll it, Mark.
It's a lovely summer night in the Napa Valley, and I'm sitting in the courtyard of Dario Satui's dream. It's his castle. Yeah, you heard right. There's a castle in Calistoga. And right now, there's a gorgeous young Italian tenor, Francesco Di Mura, singing La Donna Mobile with the Russian National Orchestra. This concert is part of the Fest del Sol, a weeks-long music festival in Napa that the castle has hosted for 2 years now. The enthusiastic audience is swooning, and I'm beginning to understand why ladies are sometimes moved to toss their lacier garments at a stage. This is a place of romance, medieval history, incredible good luck, and 15 years of hard labor in the building. Dario Satui built this castle to house his second winery, Castello di Amoroso, and to indulge his passion for medieval architecture. The place is constructed only with materials and methods available in the 13th century. I can't decide if it's Disneyland or the real thing. How odd to be in a 3-year-old castle. No centuries of dirt, no real blood flowing in the torture chamber. But it's beautifully and painstakingly realized. The castle walls are constructed as if they were built over several hundred years. Windows are bricked over, new doors interrupt bricked over windows. There are different stones, shapes, techniques evident in all the walls. My guide, Castello di Amoroso president George Salzner, explains, they could hand-carve large stones in times of plenty, but during wars and famine, when there was no time and no money, walls were patched together with flat stones and rubble. What we're seeing is a castle like no other, sprung from the mind and prodigious research of Dario Satui.
He didn't take any measurement from one castle. He went actually to 50 different ones. And what he actually did, he did his research, how castles were built in the old days, and then he built his own castle. So this castle does not exist anywhere. It's just his own imagination of his own castle. So it's probably the biggest collection of architecture of medieval castles in one castle combined you will find here.
Huge projects like this yield lots of statistics. The hand-hewn stone walls of the 120,000-square-foot building took 14 years to create. 170 shipping containers of antique bricks from crumbling Austrian and Italian castles create the interior ceilings. The finest craftspeople from Italy and Germany came over to paint frescoes for the Great Hall, hand-forge every chandelier and door hinge over open flame, and to train local laborers here in the old arts of stone carving and bricking in vaulted ceilings. The 107 rooms of this castle are mostly in service to winemaking, and are mostly underground. We head down through the hand-wrought gates. The path gently slopes down as you meander through the labyrinth of rooms, barrels and bottles stacked on all sides. George explains they use different techniques of period architecture so that each of the 170 rooms is unique.
You can see how the arch actually, it's not an arch, it comes from four sides and it meets right in the center. That's what we call a cross-vaulted ceiling. Look at this arch here. This is an arch that goes all the way to the floor. Yeah. You know, some arches start at 6 feet, but this arch goes all the way down and starts right at the floor.
The barrel room is a 12,000-square-foot room holding 40 Roman cross vaulted brick ceilings.
I mean, here you can really see the cross-vaulted ceiling. I mean, this room alone took 2.5 years to build it. Yeah. And every single brick that you see here is from Italy and from Austria. So he found that bricklayer in Austria, Fritz Gruber, who told him that you can actually buy bricks from old castles. And Dario brought approximately 170 containers of old antique bricks over here from Europe.
The room is full of wine barrels, as you might expect, and it's a busy working room. But back to the romance, on nights when the castle is in play mode, Valentine's evening, for instance, they lay a sumptuous 50-foot-long table, light the room with 1,000 tapers, and feast and drink wine with 100 guests glowing in the candlelight. Halloween is popular at the castle as well. That's when they throw a costumed pagan ball. Which brings us to the torture chamber. This room features the infamous rack and a spike-studded wooden chair that, with lighted coals underneath, became the original hot seat.
People got very creative in the old days how to torture people. It was a real art form. It's kind of scary how innovative they became when it was part of developing new torture instruments.
All in all, there are 8 different grisly torture devices. On the public tour of the castle, guide Cindy Frediani is popular for digging into the gory details.
The Iron Maiden, the Virgin of Nuremberg, invented at Nuremberg Castle in Germany. She is over 300 years old. They put you inside, shut the door, and lock you in. For every bolt on the outside, the inside has a corresponding spike that impales your body. Not long enough to hit your vital organs, that would kill you. They don't want to kill you. They want to torture you.
Dario Satui's castle is first and foremost a winery, but also a place to hear great music, admire the craftsmanship and architecture, and indulge in a bit of Middle Ages role play. The castle plays host to several costume balls throughout the year, where courtiers eat with their hands, no forks in the 13th century, at long, colorful tables in the open-air courtyard. There's jousting, sword fighting, strolling minstrels, Dario Satui's own private Ren Fair. The real chapel holds Latin Mass on Sunday mornings at 8:30, and there are regular banquets in the Great Hall, with wine club members taking the place of ancient royals.
Well, you know, the other day we were standing in the Great Hall and starting a dinner and telling the story about the castle, and we all felt a little privileged to stand in a castle that's only 3 years old, knowing that maybe 200 years from now, somebody will still have a party in that Great Hall.
The Middle Ages were a terrible time. They could have castles then because of serf labor. People were tortured, and it was freezing cold in those European palaces. Still, it's hard to shake the fairy tales when a beautiful man from Italy is returning for his third encore, and the crowd is on its feet. Francesco di Mura sings again, and we're falling for it. Love, pain, opera, stone, and let's have another glass of wine.
You're listening to Arts ID at 91 FM KRCB. That piece by Robin Pressman, excellent by the way, reminded me of something kind of interesting. That was a building that was made with an aesthetic in mind. Now, we're going to look at something that you checked out, which is a building that had a completely different purpose in mind that has been since retrofitted, in a way, into a venue.
Absolutely. I mean, not much has been done to the old slaughterhouse space, which, exactly as it sounds, is a former abattoir for processing animals in Healdsburg, and it is extraordinarily creepy and lovely and wonderful and a lot like a castle if you were in the bowels of the castle. Roll it, Mark. Meet Pat Lenz, a fiberglass sculptor who divides her time between New York and Healdsburg. Lenz and her husband own the Duchamp Hotel in downtown Healdsburg and the Duchamp Winery outside of Healdsburg. On it, they have a very unusual art space.
It was an active slaughterhouse when we bought it. It was the Vanderboon Slaughterhouse, a very large one for Northern California. I am an animal lover, vegetarian, and was glad to shut the business down and stop that, and we were not quite sure what to do with it. It's an amazing space. From the exterior, it's rather country, agricultural, white wood, but when you come inside and you see these thick concrete walls, 35-foot high ceilings with hoists and all the paraphernalia of a slaughterhouse, which was here when we bought it, it's astounding. It's really amazing to people, but it also has a sense of almost a Tribeca New York loft, mm-hmm. which I loved. When we got the space, my husband felt that the county would be thrilled if we did a winery here. We're in wine country. But the interior of the slaughterhouse space, I felt, was almost a sacred space. There's something about the history of what went on, not only to the animals, but the people, the employees who worked here, that I felt, not actually a cleansing, but I didn't want to do something in here that destroyed what the aura of what happened. I wanted a reminiscence of it. I wanted some kind of a pentimento. And it took a number of years. I'd come in here in the evening during the day and think, what can I do that will have a meaning to the space, to me, and perhaps to the community? And of course, art being my passion and career for a long time, I thought that was the healing process. We use art as a healing process for it. And the very first performance we did here was with a group called the Imaginists, who are now in Santa Rosa. They were initially in Healdsburg. And we did a one-man Hamlet. And it was wonderful. It was to candlelight. It lasted about an hour. And I think we did four performances. And it truly was magical. The next thing we did was a performance festival, and that was curated by a young man that I met through just a fluke. We were together at the Art Basel Fair in Miami, and he came up and saw the space, and he said, I'd like to do a performance festival here, and that was the beginning of it all. And then, since then, we've done a number of shows. We've had three performance festivals, and now this year we're doing our second show, which is Ordinary Miracles, after the first show, which was Endgame.
Ordinary Miracles is an art exhibit about parenthood, specifically about motherhood, but it's an art exhibit about parenthood and motherhood set in a slaughterhouse, so it's very different than anything you might expect. In fact, everything about the slaughterhouse space and the Duchamp properties is different than you might expect. I asked Pat, why the focus on Marcel Duchamp?
I was investigating him because as an artist and somebody of a different era, pre-conceptual art. I grew up with Picasso as my hero. He was the man who could do it all, and Guernica to me was one of the most powerful paintings. And then all of a sudden, the world became full of conceptual art, and everyone was an artist, and everything is art. And I thought, what is going on here? This is not a happy thing for me in a way. I wanted my hero. I liked having my hero. So I decided to read everything I could about Marcel Duchamp. And then I thought, I have to get inside this man's head. And I started making a very, very large sculpture of his head that you can actually go into. And then we started the project of the hotel and the winery, and we were trying to think of names. And the word Duchamp of the Field seemed like a beautiful name. So that's how we went with it.
Have you healed and finished with Marcel Duchamp?
Or I think we're in a post conceptual world. I really think we're in a post-medium world, and I think the art world is really in flux right now. It's very hard to keep up with it, and I think maybe the message is a good one. You just have to do your own thing in your own community and what's personal to you.
Now, the art that you show up here, and after all that, when you heal the space, but this is not tea cozies and ladies' quilts. You've made a very large effort to have very high-end cross the bridge, I guess is what we'd call it in the North Bay. And a lot of it's extremely unsettling.
Yes. Well, I felt there are so many wonderful galleries in the whole area between Sonoma County, Napa County, San Francisco, where if your interest is in beauty and landscape, there are resources for it. But I feel that here I am in one of the most beautiful parts of the world, surrounded with vineyards, and very fortunate to be here, but there is another side to life, and there is grit, and there are wars going on, and people are dying, and there's man's inhumanity to man, and I think it needs a little bit of a voice, and so I decided that's what I would do here. So we've had shows that have discussed that. We did some anti-war shows in the performances. We did a show that was by a woman whose family were Holocaust survivors. So we've touched on issues like that. Endgame, the first show of the season, was really about the end. Is it the end? Is it the end of Mother Nature as we know it? So, and Ordinary Miracles, it touches on motherhood and children from all points of view, losing children, children killed in war, abortion, but also some very beautiful work and some humorous work. But we don't try to be just proselytizing or hitting people over the head, but bringing in artists from all generations and different areas. Mm-hmm.
You also have chosen to not light the gallery in a traditional gallery style. Tell me about that.
Well, the space itself has its own magical lighting. It There was a very interesting quote from Paul McCartney, who said, if slaughterhouses had windows, we'd all be vegetarians. So to a degree, there's a truth in it, but there are windows here. They're just very high up. And of course, it's a private property, so you really cannot look in, and that's the point of it. But we get magical lighting. And the space itself has all the artifacts around, and it's anything but pristine. I mean, it's got rust on the walls and chips, and it's rough. And I think the idea of doing really formal gallery lighting or trying to whitewash things would really destroy the aura of the building. So we just let it sing its own song, basically, and I think it works very well. In fact, I've been so surprised, and so have artists who have shown here, who are used to showing in the white wall, the white cube gallery, to see how work looks in this space. It brings something to them, and vice versa.
And in fact, you and your curator often will choose to put work. With your last show, for example, the Ed Ruscha was in the darkest recesses. And as a middle-aged person, you know, I'm squinting, I can't. But that's on purpose. You're really playing with it as well.
Absolutely, there was. It was the work was about that. It was about, you know, kind of emptiness and darkness and nothing there. And making people struggle to see it was part of it.
One thing you never lose sight of when one is inside the slaughterhouse space is the fact that it was an abattoir. You've kept the drains that say blood and water, the hooks. Why was that choice?
Well, just for that very reason. First of all, I think they're part of the space. I think there's a fascination, too. The idea of these beautiful drains that do say blood and water is very interesting and lets people know that when animals are slaughtered, they actually do separate the blood and the water, and the blood went into tanks and was sold. And it maybe helps people to understand where their food comes from a little bit. Maybe I can create a vegetarian or two once in a while. But I liked keeping those things around. I think they're fascinating, and they're not art objects, but they're objects of the space, and I think belong here.
Well, and you've done the same thing with the dehider for pigs. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I loved it. We had this platform where the pigs were actually processed after they were killed. It was a scalding tank, and it was this machine that beat the bristles off the boars. But I loved the machine itself. It's out of rubber and copper, and it's got these paddles. So we just keep it. It's on the floor because it really can't be moved easily. It weighs a lot. And sometimes artists get a little like, do I have to compete with that machine? But it's just, it's there, and yes, you do, and it really adds something to the space. I love having it there. Yeah, it's an art. To me, that's a Duchampian objet d'art.
Absolutely, yeah. A ready-made. No
it question. Is, absolutely.
You're listening to Arts ID on 91 FM, KRCB. I'm Daedalus Howell.
I'm Gretchen Giles. We're going to take a little rest while Anna Schuessler, who's actually a Bohemian intern this summer, which is very cool. I got her involved in Arts ID. I'm very excited that taking a young person who still cares about radio, wow. And she's done this fantastic piece about an artist named Catherine Zolt. Catherine is participating in the Art Cinema Festival. She comes to us from Phoenix, Arizona, where she had a massive art installation that took up a 12,000 square foot space. And she's come here to Sonoma County to try to find a home for it. So we continue our look at venues with Anna Schuessler and Catherine Zolt.
Catherine Zolt likes fairy tales, but not the happy ones today's kids are brought up on. No. This sculptor, whose work will be shown in the Art Sonoma Festival in September, prefers the unsettling ones. You know, like the Grimm's fairy tales crafted with the purpose of scaring young children into staying in the house and out of the Bavarian forest? Those ones. Still don't know what I'm talking about? Here's an example.
A queen on her deathbed forbids her king to marry again, unless, she tells him, he can find another maiden as beautiful as she. The king, grieving over his wife's death, does not remarry. Many years pass. One day, he looks at his daughter and realizes that she is the only woman who could possibly replace his wife. His daughter is horrified by his plans. She stalls for time, asking him to provide her three dresses before they marry, one as golden as the sun, one as silvery as the moon, and one as bright as the stars. She also requests a cape made of fur from every animal of the forest. When her father produces all four items, she flees the kingdom. Eventually, she marries another king. She never sees her father again.
And then she's good to go, right? Stories like this one, a German fairy tale, leave macabre images in the minds of those who gather to listen to them. And even though the heroes usually emerge unscathed, or with at most minor cuts and bruises, there's always something a little unsettling about those stories, which is probably why we remember them so well. We just can't digest their hidden complexities. Catherine Zolt would agree. This German fairy tale so affected her that she recreated it in three dimensions in her latest installation, Leaving My Father's House. She installed it in Phoenix, Arizona, at the Ice House, an alternative art venue. The story provides a gateway for what Catherine Zolt would like to say about the environment and feminism. Her piece is made of three parts. The story is visually represented in a series of panels that look like carved sandstone. Then it's brought to life in the video installation, which depicts the princess's flight from her kingdom. And it all ends up in a capacious concrete room, where 40 white body casts of children hang on the walls and are reflected on the flooded floor.
First criteria is that the landlord permit me to flood the floor. And that's proven to be a bigger stumbling block than I had ever imagined, because I know that you can seal the floor up, but they don't know that, and they're not interested in having their floors flooded.
Zolt would never have imagined that the piece would travel when she began it a year and a half ago.
As I was building it, that's when the idea came that it should travel. And that really had to do with the fact that the children that we were casting were so intent on being part of this project and having a voice in the issues that were environmental. It became clear that it wasn't my project anymore, and that it really needed to travel. And maybe we could cast children in other towns and include them in the project and move along and let it grow as we moved along. It just became apparent that the community wanted it.
So it's great that the piece wants to travel, but the next obvious question is, where is it going to go? Who's going to take a piece with these kinds of dimensions and allow the artist to flood the floor? Zolt herself couldn't be sure, but with a couple run-ins with the media and a little bit of coincidence, she was able to eke out a path for the installation's next destination. Landing a spot in the Arts Sonoma Festival, Zolt could at least rest assured that the work would have an exhibition space. She hooked up with Jennifer Sloan and John Moran of the Arts Council, and they began to plan.
And then Jennifer Sloan called me to say that they had a venue in Geyserville and that I should come and take a look at it. So I drove up and was surprised that they pointed to the exterior of a red brick building. I thought they had an interior space for me. And they had wanted me to put the pieces on the exterior so that people could see them and it would draw attention. And I stood there and I looked at it and I thought, I went blank, because it wasn't what I was expecting at all. But from the second story of that building, I looked over and noticed a post office. And it was, I could see from where I was standing that it was empty. And I thought, oh my God, it's perfect. It's about the right size. It's the minimum size. I could tell that it wasn't very large. It had a flat roof and it looked rough. It looked like somebody would let me flood it if I wanted to, so.
The next day, Zolt took matters into her own hands and marched into the offices of LaFranchi Architecture and Development, the firm that was responsible for the post office. Much to her surprise, she was recognized immediately. One woman in the office had just read a story about Zolt in the Press Democrat that very day, and she hardly had to explain her predicament to owner Ken LaFranchi before the firm was on board.
I walked up the stairs and announced that I was looking for a venue, and she said, you're the woman in the newspaper. And I said, yes, I am. And she was very supportive and excited. And she went to Ken and she said, she explained why I was there. And I went in and he was absolutely gracious. And said, yes. He said, I love what you're doing. He took a look at the website and he said, yes, I love this. This is great.
New venue? Check. But where to begin with the moving process? Zolt had already done that once when she moved the body casts from her Sonoma studio to Phoenix for its first exhibition. It ended in disaster.
I was sure that the piece would travel easily, and I was dead wrong. The first venture, they were all boxed up and crated, and the crate was dropped, and the pieces arrived totally broken.
Some accidents are beautiful, though, and this one was no exception.
We were able to fix almost everything. Mm-hmm. The only reason I didn't fix the last, I think it was 14 or 15 of them, was because I would never have broken them for another installation or for another piece. But because they were already broken, they lent themselves to a piece called The End of the Fairy Tale.
Zolt definitely proved her resilience with that save. She also learned some lessons.
On the way back, we just actually rented a trailer, and we totally cushioned the trailer with blankets and puffy things and just packed them up to the ceiling, and they arrived home in perfect form.
All of Catherine Zolt's fragile body casts, even after the 15-hour drive from Phoenix to Sonoma, made it back to their origin without so much as a scratch, but only under the careful eye of their creator. As for the piece's next stop...
I'm actually thinking of putting a posting onto Craigslist to see if I can find out if people are interested in having the exhibition come to their town.
But of course, with a piece like this one, Zolt will have to rely on more eclectic ways of finding a venue.
You just have a hit on something. When you see it, you know that it captures the feeling of the work or could create a space that was like a grotto. And that's what I'm looking to create.
Catherine Zolt exhibits Leaving My Father's House from September 10th to September 12th at Geyserville's Old Post Office as part of the Art Sonoma Festival. You can find out all about the festival at artsonoma.org.
I must say, Anna Schuessler's story there is probably the only one that has a happy ending, in terms of fairy tales.
Absolutely. And, you know, the search that Catherine Zolt went through to find a place where she could flood the floor. I mean, I love that. You know, that was really the big part of it.
She could come into my bathroom next time. That happens all the time.
When you've got a one-year-old in a tub,
yes, indeed.
It does. You can always hear more about Arts ID online at artsid.org or at krcb.org. Arts ID is a monthly audio magazine brought to you by the North Bay Bohemian, the Arts Council Sonoma County, and KRCB Sonoma County Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Giles, having the time of my life.
I'm Daedalus Howell, trying to get a word in.
There's no
venue for my words here.
Next month, we'll find them a home, Dee. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Arts ID is produced and edited by Robin Pressman and engineered by Gregory DiMasio. We had contributions this month from James Michael Berry, Anna Schuessler, Gretchen Giles, Robin Pressman, John Moran, and many artists from the Art Sonoma Festival. Join us online at artsid.org or at krcb.org. You can hear the whole show in both places.